Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 118, Kitchen Questions, Preserving Food. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, having more fun, learning new things. Got an interesting episode lined up for you today. I was actually going to do a kitchen questions episode where I take questions that have come in over social media or email and kind of answer them a la carte. But I noticed a trend on a couple of the questions that have come in, and I thought it would maybe be better to focus on a particular topic that are spurred by these questions. So today, I want to take a few minutes and talk a little bit about preserving food, and there are a couple of different questions with different angles on this. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. Before we get to that, however, I do want to do just a quick bit of housekeeping. First of all, if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. Glad you found us. Looking forward to sharing lots of fun cooking and kitchen-related stuff with you in the months to come. I want to remind everybody, if you'd like to get in touch with me, there's a couple of really good ways to do that. One is to send me an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. I will answer every email I get. Happy to answer questions, just have a chit-chat, whatever it is. If you have ideas for show topics or questions you'd like me to address on an upcoming show or just want to say hi, email's a great way to do it. Another good way to do it, and I get several of these, is through Facebook in the Facebook Messenger app. So if you head over to the show's Facebook page at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast, you can send me a message that way. And I do my best to get back to those within a day or so or earlier. So that's another way you can contact me. And I also want to mention, if you didn't listen to the most recent episode, it was just a couple of minutes long and it was a special announcement. I talked about starting a special Facebook group, a closed Facebook group, for the podcast that I am calling the Kitchen Counter Coffee Break. I set that up because I'm not really active on the main Kitchen Counter Podcast Facebook page, and I thought a group would be a better way to bring some listeners together who would like to interact with me and one another. And I think a Facebook group is a really good way to do that. It's just a great platform for conversation. So if you haven't checked it out and you're interested in joining the group, just head over, the easy link would be head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group, and that'll actually take you over to Facebook where you can put a request in to join the group. Once I approve your request, you're in. You can see conversations, you can post questions, food pictures, share recipes, ask other community members questions, whatever it is. It's a way, hopefully, that we can start interacting with one another on a little more regular basis in a way that allows us to share information and ask questions easier. So the Kitchen Counter Coffee Break Facebook group, I do encourage you to go check that out. I think over time it's going to grow into a fun little community. We're already having some good conversations over there with the folks that have already hopped in. All right, I think that's enough housekeeping for now. So why don't we jump right in and tackle a couple of questions that I receive that have to do with preserving food at home. So we're coming kind of over the hump on summertime here, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. And I think my thoughts, at least, I know many of yours are as well, are kind of turning to the upcoming bounty of food from the harvest season, but also all of this great stuff that's coming on in the summertime here. What to do with it. Some of us have gardens. Some of us grow herbs. Some of us have tomatoes that we're getting a lot of, or fruit trees. And, you know, you can only eat so much of that yourself, and you can only give so much of that away. So what do you do with some of this other stuff? Or perhaps you like to go to, let's say, a farmer's market or the fruit stand or whatever, and pick up a bunch of fresh produce, and you would like to preserve that. So the two questions or topics I want to address today in preserving food are, I put together basically from a conglomeration of several questions that have come in over the last couple of weeks, sort of relating to both of these items. So I'm not going to recount specific questions that came in, but I'll set up what the general gist of each question was, and then we'll get into a little bit of detail. So the first question I got about preserving food had actually to do specifically with herbs, and I've actually seen a couple of people mention this in some messages that they sent me, and actually I'm dealing with the same thing right now. And the idea is, if you've got a windowsill herb garden, or you're growing herbs in your garden bed or the backyard, most likely your herb garden is producing way more than you could possibly deal with. I mean, I've got an herb planter that has some thyme, basil, some rosemary, some sage. I think I've got some mint growing in there. And while I do, when I'm cooking, I do go out and I clip some as I need it. There's still way more out there that I'm going to be able to use. So the questions centered around what can you do with these herbs to make them last longer? I want to talk about that first. And there's a couple of really easy things you can do to preserve your herbs. And by the way, as I mentioned, these don't need to be herbs that you grow yourself. You might see them for sale at the farmer's market, and some really lush, fresh herbs. And you may not be able to use them right away, but you want to take them home and do something with them. So one thing I would say is drying your own herbs is easy. It's a lot of fun. And when your herbs are dried, they'll last for potentially a year or maybe even a little bit longer. This is basically the same thing that you get when you go to the store and you buy a little jar of dried thyme or dried basil or oregano or whatever. Except this is how you can make that same thing at home and, you know, put them in your own little jars up in your spice cabinet. First method for drying herbs is, I would just call it the bag drying method. And let's use something like a rosemary for an example. So, you know, rosemary grows on sort of long woody stems, and the leaves, you know, grow right off the stem. So one thing you can do with things like rosemary or even thyme or other things like that, sage, is you can clip the stems right down at the base. So you end up with these long stalks of herbs right on the stem. And then you can take something like a little bit of butcher string or twine, and or even like a garbage bag twist ties. Those work really well. And you bunch up your herbs at the base. So you basically have a bundle of your herbs. And you probably want to use all the same type of herb in one bundle. You probably don't want to mix, at least while you're drying. So you can keep them separate. So when you go to put them in jars later, you'll know what they all are. But so you make a bundle of your herbs. You take just a brown paper bag big enough to fit the bundle lengthwise, and you put your bundle in and you cinch up the bag around the base of your herb bundle. So you've basically stuffed the leafy end of the herb stalks down into your bag. You've cinched up the bag. You could tie that off with a little bit of string, because you're probably going to want to hang it up somewhere. And then what you want to do is just, cut a few little holes into that paper bag to let the air circulate. The reason you want to put it in a bag is it actually keeps the dust off your herbs. And you know what? I should have mentioned this right at the beginning. You're probably going to want to wash your herbs off too before you dry them. Just, rinse them under some cool water and make sure you pat them very dry or let them air dry before you put them in the bags for your drying process. You want to get as much moisture off of those as possible. Okay, so anyway, now you've got a bag with herbs in it. You're going to want to hang them up in a relatively warm place, but you don't want them in direct sunlight. You don't want moisture to condense inside the bag. You want those air holes, like I said, in the bag to let air flow through, keep the dust off your herbs. And after, depending on how lush and the type of herbs, you might be ready to go after a week. It might take a couple of weeks. But at some point, you can check those herbs and they should be dry and crunchy or crumbly, the consistency that you would imagine you would need to put those dried herbs into a jar. So that's the first method, is just drying your herbs in a bag. The second method I would call just the oven drying method. This is a good method if you don't have a lot of time to mess around with drying herbs in a bag, even though it's a lot of hands-off time, right? But if you need your herbs dried a little bit quicker, or if you live in a wet or a very humid climate and your herbs might not dry, and it could be too moist in the air and they might develop mold or mildew, the oven drying method might be a good approach. So most ovens, the lowest heat setting is probably about 170 degrees Fahrenheit. That's going to be a little too warm, probably, to dry your herbs without scorching them or burning them. So one thing you could do after, again, you've cleaned and thoroughly dried your herbs is you can lay them out on a cookie sheet, probably on a piece of parchment paper in a single layer. You could preheat your oven to 170 degrees and then turn your oven off. And ideally, you're going to want your oven probably between, let's say, 110 degrees down to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So, turn your oven off, let it cool down. If you have a thermometer that you can monitor your oven temperature with, that's great. If not, you can, wait half an hour or something like that. Pop your herbs in that are on the tray into the oven. Let them sit in there with the oven door cracked open for probably about an hour, maybe an hour and a half. You'll check them as they're going, and that might be enough to dry your herbs out. So you can get the oven method going, and in an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours at the most, depending on how lush and thick your herbs are, you'll have herbs that are ready again to dry, crumble up, put in your herb jars, and you're ready to go. Now, when I was thinking about preserving herbs and drying herbs, it was another method that came up that I was not familiar with. I had not used before, but that is using your microwave to dry herbs. So I read about this and I thought it was interesting, and I gave it a shot myself and it worked great. I couldn't believe how well it actually did work. It's going to be useful for smaller quantities of herbs, right? You're not going to be able to tie a whole bunch together and put them in the microwave like you will with the bag method. You're not going to be able to lay a whole cookie sheet out with herbs and put them in your oven. So we're really talking about, just probably a sprig or two, or whatever type of herb you're using, several leaves. I tried this with sage, and I probably had a half a cup of leaves that I spread out in the microwave. So for the microwave method, what you want to do is I used a paper plate and a couple of pieces of kitchen paper towel, and I laid the paper plate down. I put a layer of paper towel down, and then I took my sage leaves off of the stems. You're going to want to do this for whatever your herbs are. So if you're using rosemary, again, you're going to want to pull all the rosemary leaves off that woody stem. If you're doing thyme, you're going to want to pull the thyme off the stem. So you just want the leaf part of the herb. Spread them out in a single layer on the paper towel, and then lay another paper towel on top. And then I put it in the microwave for about 30 seconds on high. And then when the 30 seconds was done, I turned my herbs over, and you could probably just lift up your paper towels, clamp together, flip it all over. And I did another 30 seconds. And at that point, I started checking the herbs. And my sage was really close after a minute of doing this, so I put it in for another 30 seconds, at which time it was perfect. It was vibrant green. It looked like fresh sage, but when I picked up the sage leaves, they were dry and brittle, and I could just crumble them into fine little bits, like you'd find in a spice jar in the store. So the microwave method only took about a minute and a half, maybe a couple of minutes with the preparation. But it wasn't a very big quantity. So think of the three ways that I've mentioned to do your herbs. You can do the bag drying method for large bunches. It takes a couple of weeks probably to get your herbs dry. Only really good for dry areas. The oven method, a lot quicker, about an hour or two, probably can do quite a few herbs on a cookie sheet. So that's the second method. And then if you just need some dried herbs on the quick, the microwave method works really good. Of course, what I didn't mention is using an actual food dehydrator, which also would certainly work very well. And then you would just follow whatever directions your food dehydrator has for drying herbs and vegetables and things like that. And that'll work great too. Now, there's a couple of other things you can do with herbs if you don't need to, say, save them for a year or longer. There are a couple of other really quick things you can do, and one is freezing them. So a very popular preparation for herbs I see all the time for basil, for example, is to make a basil pesto and freeze the pesto. And those will freeze in small containers very nicely, and those will stay really good for, let's say, 2 or 3 months. If you're not into making full-on pesto sauce or other sauces, you could just chop up or blend up your herbs, your fresh herbs, and put them, I've seen the ice cube tray method, right? So you take an ice cube tray, you pack each tray compartment with maybe halfway with whatever herb mixture you're trying to preserve. And then you could pour in, say, olive oil to fill the ice cube tray up. And then when you freeze those ice cube trays, you'll have these nice little blocks of olive oil and herb mixtures that then you can use right out of the freezer if you need to, you know, for whatever application you're using them for, soup, stew, sauteing, that sort of a thing. And again, those will probably be good for 2 to 3 months. Any longer than that, it's, you know, they're going to start freezer burning and probably start losing a lot of their potent flavor. And then the last thing I would mention, if you want to preserve herbs for an even shorter amount of time, you can do things like making compound butter with your herbs, with your fresh herbs in them. And you can freeze compound butter as well, you know, for a month or two. So there's things you can do with fresh herbs that, you know, before they wilt and die in your herb garden, that you can get a little extra time out of them. So that was one of the questions I got, which was preserving herbs. That was probably a really long answer for that relatively simple question. The second question or sets of questions I got probably deserve a multi-part podcast series. I could probably do several episodes on this, but I thought we're in the height of preserving season, so it would probably be a good idea just to talk a little bit about the basics of preserving food by canning. So I know a couple people, when they joined the Facebook group, mentioned that's something they want to learn more about. I received a couple emails asking about canning questions and resources and things like that. So I'm going to take a few minutes here and I'm going to lay out some of the basics of canning food, because I think if you've never done it, but you're interested in doing it, it sounds very intimidating. It's something akin to cooking with a pressure cooker. If you've never done it, it sounds very intimidating. It sounds like if you screw it up, you're in trouble. And to some degree, that is true, but it's not so scary once you just understand the basics behind canning. I'm not going to be talking about fermenting. That's a whole different conversation about preserving food. And in fact, if you're interested in fermenting, I did do an episode a while back, episode 72, where I interviewed Derek Dillinger, who wrote a book called The Fermented Man, A Year on the Front Lines of a Food Revolution. And we did get into not only discussion about his book and living off of nothing but fermented foods for a year, we did talk about some of the fundamentals of fermenting your own food at home. So you can check that out if you're interested back at episode 72. So just go to kitchencounterpodcast.com/72 and it'll take you to the show notes and you can listen to the podcast episode there. So fermenting, certainly a valuable, viable way to preserve food, but let's talk about canning for a minute. And let me lay out just the basics of canning. So what is canning? Well, canning is for the home cook, a way to preserve food in glass jars where the food does not need to be refrigerated after it's preserved. And in some cases, the food that's preserved can last for years in a nice, properly prepared, you know, glass jar preserving method. Now, there are a couple of things to keep in mind when it comes to canning food. And you've probably heard terms like hot water bath canning, pressure canning, low acidity foods, high acidity foods, that sort of stuff. So what does all that mean? Well, let's start with the acidity of foods. So all food has some sort of a pH level, and the pH level is basically just a measure of how acidic a particular food is naturally. So on a scale of pH, you look at a scale from 1 to 14 on a total pH scale. Now here's the weird part. It's counterintuitive because pH measures the acidity of food, but the lower the pH level, the higher the natural acidity of the food. The higher the number of pH, the lower the natural acidity of food is. Most anything we're going to be dealing with for food is going to range from 2 to 7 on the pH scale. Okay, so very acidic is low pH number. So think of a lemon, which is down near like the 2 for pH, very acidic. as opposed to, say, like mushrooms, which are going to be lower on the acidity scale. They're probably like at a 6.5 pH or something like this. So pH level is the acidity level of food. So that goes a long way in determining what kind of canning method you're going to use, whether you can use the hot water bath canning method or the pressure canning method. And the reason that matters, and they're not interchangeable, those two different methods, is because of the bacteria botulism. Okay. Now, a couple of things about botulism. So first of all, botulism is caused by a spore that is found everywhere. The spore itself is not inherently dangerous to us. Now, the bad thing about botulism is when the spores are in an environment that's very low oxygen, high moisture, and a comfortable temperature, not too hot, not too cold, it can lead to bacteria that produces a neurotoxin, and it's really nasty stuff. And botulism can kill people fairly easily. It's not something you really want to mess with. The other thing about botulism is the spores themselves cannot be killed at the temperature of boiling water, which is 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So 212 Fahrenheit boiling water will not kill the spores that cause botulism. It'll kill the bacteria, the botulism bacteria, but it will not kill the spores. Now, if there's a high acidic environment, 212 can kill the spores that cause botulism. Hope this is not too confusing. Just follow me here for just a couple more minutes. So if you have a highly acidic food, like most fruits, pickles, you know, vinegar is highly acidic, of course. If you have a highly acidic food, you can can that using a hot water bath method, which is basically immersing your jars of food into water that you bring up to boiling temperature for a certain amount of time. So that boiling water causes the heat to go through convection through your jars, through your food. And then the combination of the high acid in the jars and the 212 degree temperature will eradicate the botulism spores or bacteria that might be present in those jars, you know, therefore preserving them effectively. Now, if you have a low acid food, let's use the mushroom example again. Let's say you're canning mushrooms, you're preserving mushrooms. There is not enough acid in that jar to kill botulism at 212 degrees boiling water, right? So that is not going to be enough. You need to actually pressure can low acidity foods. And when you put your jars in a pressure cooker, you can actually raise the temperature up to above 240 degrees Fahrenheit, which is hot enough to kill botulism spores, even in a low acid environment. Okay. So to recap, for highly acidic foods, you can use the water bath canning. Things like pickles and a lot of fruits are highly acidic. You can use the simple water bath canning. For low acid foods, you need to use the pressure canning method. Now, the difference between the two methods, besides what I've just kind of explained in regards to food safety, is equipment, of course. So with a water bath canning setup, it's very simple, and in fact, most of the time you can build this. If you have a large enough stock pot at home, you could build a water bath canning system at home, mainly with what you have. You can also buy kits at places like Walmart or Target or your local hardware store, food shop. They're usually like a giant, large stainless steel or enameled steel tub with a rack inside, and then you can usually pick up some extra equipment like a jar, carriers, and you know, lid holders and all that kind of stuff. But it's a fairly easy method to get started with. So if you want to do things like jams, jellies, fruits, tomato sauces, for the most part, things like that, it's really easy to get started with hot water bath canning. Pressure canning, of course, requires more specialized equipment. You need a canning system, a pressure cooker that's made for canning. Again, you can find those at most big box retailers, online and Amazon. I'll put some links in the show notes over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/118. But you're going to need a little bit more specialized equipment. That's not something you can, rig up at home on your own. You want pressure cookers that are made specifically for canning to be the safest you can be when it comes, you know, to pressure canning at home. And though that sounds intimidating, there's really nothing to be afraid of. I mean, if you understand, again, low acidity, high acidity means the difference between hot water bath canning and pressure canning. I mean, that's most of the battle right there. Now, the other great thing is you don't really need to know what the pH is of a bunch of different foods. If you find reputable places to get canning recipes, the canning recipes will be tested, and they're going to tell you what method you need to use along with what other ingredients you need to include in your jars in order to make it food safe. So I mentioned tomato sauce earlier, for example. So, you know, tomatoes are a very acidic food. However, tomatoes, not all tomatoes fall below 4.6 pH, which is what you need to be below in order to just do the hot water bath canning method. So any good recipe that's going to take you through canning tomato sauce is going to have you add some extra acid in order to bring that pH level down enough. So you'll see recipes that are going to call for, you know, like a tablespoon of lemon juice or a couple tablespoons of vinegar or something like that to go into your jars with your tomato sauce so you can get that pH level down so you can raise the acidity to make it safe for hot water bath canning. And there are a couple of really good resources when it comes to canning and preserving that I want to tell you about. And one, if you're interested in this at all, I think it's imperative for you to pick up a copy of the Ball Blue Book Guide to Preserving. So Ball, the company that makes, you know, canning jars and canning equipment, they have been printing a guide for, I don't even know how long, it's been around a long time. I think it's in its 35th or 36th edition or something like that. But not only does it have the basics of home canning and preserving, but it's got tons of great recipes. And in fact, it's a guide to preserving. So it doesn't just have canning recipes. It has how to preserve by freezing, by dehydrating, by all sorts of other methods than just canning. But the recipes in here you can trust are tested. They work. So if you follow those recipes and do not deviate at all from what they tell you to do in the recipe, you're going to be good. Canning and preserving is not a place to experiment too much with what you're putting into the jars. Yes, different spices and salt mixtures and stuff like that, herbs, that's not that big of a deal. But when a recipe tells you this is how much vinegar to put in, this or whatever the liquid mixture is, you have to be very careful and follow that exactly, because again, those recipes are tested for food safety, and that's to ensure that when you follow those directions, your food is going to be free from botulism and totally safe to store and eat. I don't want to sound scary about it. I'm not trying to scare you, but it's just simply the fact that if you follow the directions in places like the Ball, the Blue Book of preserving, you're going to be okay. Another really great resource in general is to find your local university extension office website, or go to one of their local extension offices and ask them for information on canning and preserving. This is something that pretty much all of them deal with on a regular basis. And there are some really great resources available locally. And I like to recommend the local extension offices because they're probably going to have really good information on food that's grown local in your area. So if you have you know, specialty crops that are really unique to your area or really common in your area, they're probably going to have really good information on those particular fruits or vegetables when it comes to canning and preserving. So for me, it's the Oregon State University Extension Office. They have excellent resources and downloads and printables for canning and preserving. I'll put a link to their website in the show notes. But again, I encourage you to go and find your local university extension office and poke around online and see what they have. But lacking that, the OSU one has a great resource. So I'll put that in the show notes. I know that didn't get into a lot of detail on how to actually can and preserve. Again, I think I'll probably do another episode and I'll take some specific examples and go through those with you. But I just wanted to kind of lay out, based on some of the questions I'm getting, the basics so you understand what it is you're getting into when you're talking about canning and preserving food. And again, just to recap, it's the high acidity / low pH is the hot water canning method. A lot simpler, a lot easier. than the alternative, which is pressure canning for the high pH / low acidity foods. So again, I'll put some information in the show notes so you can check that out for yourself. But, and I'll also put a link to the Ball Blue Book on preserving, because it's seriously, it's one of the best resources I've ever seen for canning and preserving. Okay, I hope that was interesting and useful for you. I know it was a little bit hopping across the board there, but I wanted to tackle two sets of questions I've been getting fairly frequently. How do you preserve herbs, which is a very interesting question and very easy to deal with, and then the little more complicated bit about canning and preserving. But the takeaway there, again, don't be afraid of it. If you're interested in doing it, maybe start out with things you can do with the hot water bath method, because it's easy and it's a lot of fun. I might personally recommend looking up a recipe for dilly beans, which is essentially dill pickled green beans. It's my favorite thing to make and to eat that's pickled. Don't tell anybody, but they're way better than pickles, and I love pickles. All right, so that's going to do it for today's episode. I want to remind you again, head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group if you're interested in joining our fun little Facebook community, the Kitchen Counter Coffee Break, or send me an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And if you're so inclined and you get some value out of the show, I would love if you go to wherever it is you consume this podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Google Podcasts, whatever, and leave a rating and review and tell your friends and family about it. That really helps out. Well, I'm looking forward to bringing you some more episodes in the near future. I'm going to get back into a more regular recording rhythm now that summer is kind of winding down and I'm wrapping things up. I'm not too busy outside, or I won't be soon. But I do have a couple more summer things left up my sleeve that I'm going to be bringing you. All right, everybody. Thank you once again so much for listening. I really, really appreciate you spending time with me. And if there's ever anything I could do for you, please let me know. All right. Until next time, I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.